Welcome to the Chris Mack Fitness Podcast, where we will discuss health, fitness, biohacking, human potential, and how you can achieve your full potential. Enjoy the show. Okay, today we're with Johnny Muir. Johnny Muir is a hill runner and author of The Mountains Are Calling, which is a book about running in the high places of Scotland. It's full of inspiring stories. He's interviewed many runners over the years to basically write this book. And if you have a read of this, this will really get you into the mood for some hill running. Every time I pick this up again, I'm reading about some new places that I want to go and visit. So, Johnny, it's great to have you here. Looking forward to our conversation tonight.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, really good to meet you and talk.
Yeah, it's nice to put a face to the book, so to speak, you know.
Well, people I meet who have never met me before assume I'm some 60-year-old bearded sort of fellow rather than someone who's a bit younger and still runs actively on the hills.
It's funny that you said that because there is a picture of you on the back here. I don't know if people will be able to see.
Yes, yeah.
And yes. I don't think you've aged that much. You definitely, your hair looks more windswept in that photo than it does right now. But because I was thinking that, it's funny you said that. I was thinking that earlier on. I was thinking, I wonder if he's going to be like really old and like, because there's a lot of stories in that book and it sounds like, you know, it sounds like you've done a fair bit in the hills, you know?
Yes. Yeah. And I was quite conscious as well to not to frame the story too much in our current times. I wanted it to be a reflection of the years that have gone by. Mm-hmm. So the book stood the test of time, basically. So it wasn't just about hill running in 2018 or 2019, but it was a book about hill running going back from when it began, really.
Yeah, because the book actually does begin with the beginnings of hill running, which is a really interesting story. Do you want to share that with the listeners, if anybody hasn't really heard about the origins?
Well, obviously, it's impossible to say when hill running began, but there was certainly an organised race back in the 11th century that was organised by a king in Scotland, and it was up and down a small hill near Braemar in the Scottish Highlands, and essentially it was in an era when Scotland or the clans would need various messengers to be able to run across the hills and through the glens to give messages and say when clan members were needed in a time of war or crisis or emergency and so forth. So the runners would be selected in this race. And in the end, this race was between these two brothers to get to the top of this hill on the edge of Braemar. And as you can imagine, that story has been romanticised over the years and turned into some sort of myth. And I've gone along with that as well, because I think hill running has that romantic quality to it. And I think I can imagine it had quite a romantic beginning. Okay. Having said that, as a hill runner yourself, and of course I've experienced a lot of hill running is deeply unromantic and hard, but it still retains that sort of romantic edge to it.
Yeah, was there not a period where it got banned for quite a long time, didn't it, as well?
Yeah, it was the same event. So it was, I think, 1850, 1848, around that time. So Queen Victoria was watching the Braemar Games, just as monarchs continue to watch the Braemar Games, although, of course, not this year because it's been cancelled for COVID again. But the monarch deemed that it was too dangerous. It was against the nature of humans to be able to run up a hill at such a speed.
Yeah.
It's so banned for a proportion of time, which, yeah, there you go.
there's definitely a certain type of character that runs in hills, like, you know. If you're not into hill running and you see somebody running up a hill, people can perceive it as mad, don't they, or crazy. Like, look at that crazy guy, and it's...
Yeah.
But actually, I read your blog recently, your most recent one, I think it was, actually, about how you don't think that hill runners are mad. You think the opposite. Is that right?
I've written about this a few times, and I wrote about it most recently because there was a friend of mine called Christopher O'Brien. His favourite hill, well, he lives in Edinburgh, and his favourite hill is Alamuir, so a hill that's just under 500 metres, and it's pretty much the first and most obvious hill you see from Edinburgh in the northerly Pennines. And he loves this hill, and he wanted to run up it as many times as he could in 24 hours. And many people think, well, that's a stupid thing to do, it's madness. But I think exactly the opposite. I think that's just a beautiful idea. It's just a brilliant idea. Just for one day of my life, just one day, one 24-hour period, I'm going to see how many times I can go from here to there and back down. I just think that's a beautiful idea. And I think you're mad, not necessarily to do that, but you're mad not to buy into that sort of idea. I've just been reading Damien Hall's book about fastest known times, and he makes the same point in his first chapter, or very early on in the book anyway, this idea that he feels sorry for people who haven't got a 4 a.m. alarm call on their phone, or sorry for people who haven't had custard for breakfast. Is that sense that what's the point in living a life that's just easy and straightforward and never pushes you out of your comfort zone in any sort of way? And that doesn't need to be hill running, but for hill runners, that's the way, you know, we find that extraordinary in what often are quite ordinary lives that a lot of us live. So that term madness really drives me mad. I think it's lazy. I think it's really lazy. To me, mad is binge watching a Netflix series for 8 hours. That's mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
Why do you want to do that?
It's amazing the amount of potential that people have, and they have no idea that what they could do, you know. And it might, like you say, it might not be hill running. It could be anything. But then, at least with hill running as well, there's a health aspect to it as well. You know, it's you're exercising, you're getting out in the outdoors and stuff. Whereas, like you say, sitting binge watching Netflix, you're just like basically decomposing your body. In a way, you know, so saying that not that 24 hours up and down the same hill is maybe not the best thing in the world physically for you, could hurt yourself, but you know, it's if you train properly and build up the strength, then it's
And these 20, I've done a few 24 hour things, and I look back at them now, and I look back at them very soon after I'd done them, and I used to think that 24 hours, what a magical period of time. And you look back, think, What I did in those hours, you know, I look back as I did Rigby Round, which is a loop of all the Munros and the Cairngorms, and I think, wow, in a 24-hour period of my life, I achieved so much. And think how often we have days or weeks that go past and we really achieve nothing at all. It's funny, isn't it? I'm well aware that achievement within 24 hours is a consequence of the many hours you spent previously preparing. But still, isn't it amazing what can be achieved in just a segment of time?
Yeah, that is amazing.
It still blows me away.
Yeah, I suppose before we get into the rounds a bit too much, do you want to share how you initially got into hill running? What was your, what kind of drove you to it?
I was trying to remember this when you mentioned it earlier. I did the hill race on Snowdon, the Snowdon International Hill Race, maybe in 2005 or 2006, or maybe even earlier. And that was just a consequence of me being a runner and running marathons and 10Ks and some trail running and some cross-country running for clubs. I've always run since school. And then I did quite a lot of walking up hills, and I traveled around the country doing that. And I guess running and hill running became sort of fused together. Again, a point I make in the book is that there was a time in my life when there was running and there was hills and mountains, and the two things were just totally separate. And then there became a period where the two things were indivisible, and it's the same now. And I hope it will be the same for quite a long time, as long as I'm fit and able enough that there is running and there are the hills, and they are joined. It's not often I'll go to the hills to walk. You know, I'll always go to run. And I'm afraid beyond that, I'm a bit of a cliche, because like a lot of people, I read Feast in the Clouds by Richard Asquith. And I was living in London at the time. Or actually, I was sort of dotted. I was living in Peterborough and I was dotted around the country in different places, but I certainly wasn't living in the Lake District. And I read Feast in the Clouds and I got caught up in the romance of all that. And some friends of mine, I remember I was at the track in Tooting Beck in South London one night, and a friend of mine, Robin, he said, "Oh, I probably said, what are you doing at the weekend?" It was Tuesday night. He said, "Oh, I'm going to the Lake District to recce your leg of the Bob Graham rounds." And I knew what he was talking about. And I said, "Oh, can I come? Is that all right?" And I remember texting afterwards, sort of proving my credentials, saying, "Oh, I've run for the hills in a couple of hours and I did the Snowden race." I wanted to sort of prove to him that I was capable of doing it. And I went up with him to the lakes and we recce'd a leg, and it was fantastic and it was hard. And then the guys I was with that weekend, they went on to do the Bob Graham rounds the following year. I did it a few weeks after they had done it. So I got around the Bob Graham pretty much on 50 miles a week training in London. And then once you've been drawn into these circles of the Bob Graham round, you do runs like the Fellsman, and then inevitably you're drawn to other rounds and other fell races and long distance things, and you just get caught in this world. You get caught in the web of hill running and ultra hill running, and it's quite hard to extricate yourself from that world.
Would you want to extricate yourself from that world though?
No, and partly from reading Damien Hall's book, I sometimes feel a bit embarrassed about it, like a bit. You know, I do love running, and it is a really important thing to me. Is it an obsession? I don't know. But reading Damien's stuff is interesting to hear him say sort of quite unashamedly, "No, I love running, and it is an obsession, and it has taken over my life at different points." And is that a bad thing? You know, I don't think it is. But I'm very much aware that it's about me. It's about my sort of self-worth and me doing things I want to do. Because I was chatting to my wife, because we've got three children and she's got her own agenda and things that she's doing. And I said, "Oh," the conversation we all have with our spouses, "Oh, this weekend and this weekend, are you doing anything?" And she's like, "No, what are you doing?" And I just said, "Oh, I might be helping out on some Ramsey round, and there's this weekend free here and my dad's up, and so therefore I might have a go at something." And she doesn't really care. She's like, "Yeah, do whatever you want." It's like, "Do you not want to know what I'm doing?" It's like, no, it's all right. You'll be fine. So I know very much it's not about me trying to impress anyone, or it's not about social media, or it's not even about writing another book. It's purely me wanting to go out and do something, which is the best reason in the world, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah. It's amazing that people over time, they kind of learn that you're just going to go out and go into the hills. Like you said there, you're speaking to your wife and she just kind of gets it now. It's like, this is what Johnny does. You know, it's I kind of went through that transition as well with my wife. It's like, for a while, it was kind of, there was a bit like, "Oh, what are you doing that again?" Now it's just like kind of accepted that, all right, okay. he's off to the hills again. Off you go.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that you've done the Bob Graham round training just in London. So that's, for anybody that's kind of uninitiated to that, it's a very, very hilly route, the Bob Graham round. And London doesn't have very many hills, does it? So it's...
No, London's not as bad as some places. It could be worse. I suppose... the Bob Graham round. I guess the problem I've got with the Bob Graham round these days is that I've done other things that I would deem as harder. Mm-hmm. But I'm very well aware that when I was training for the Bob Graham round, the Bob Graham round seemed the most incredible thing in the world to achieve and to accomplish. So I did take it seriously, and I think I was just very fit. Mm-hmm. Like anything, if you go into a challenge fit, injury-free, confident, you've got a pretty good chance of getting through. and with really good support. So I ran about 50 miles a week, and I was trying to, I remember trying to climb 5,000 feet a week, which would frankly seem small fry now compared to what I do at the hills a week, each week at the moment. 5,000 feet I'd get quite easily. And I did hill reps, and you know, we did our time. We racked all of the legs. We knew exactly where we were going. There was no following a GPS trace or, you know, being led around. We knew exactly where we were going. We knew where the next bit of the hill was. So I thought we did it properly, just, I guess, unconventionally, because we had to keep coming from London to do it. But anyway, it made it more exciting, you know, leaving London on a Friday afternoon and pitching a tent in wherever, and then the next day you'd be up in the hills early, and then because you're committed to a certain weekend, the weather could be rubbish. But it was great to train for that and to see my mates do it, and then to them to help me do it. It was just fantastic.
Yeah, I bet it was so refreshing to get out in London as well, and just, you know, just get into the hills at the weekends, and, you know, just give you a break from the city.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, I live in Edinburgh now, so I can get to the Pentlands within 15 minutes on foot every single day if I want, but I can remember that yeah, almost that ability to be able to breathe leaving London. And sometimes it would take 2 hours to get to the M25, and then you've got miles and miles and miles to go past Birmingham and up to the north.
Yeah.
Those are the days.
Yeah, Edinburgh's great. I love the Pentlands as well. Like, it's a great little set of hills there. There's a lot of a lot of running history in the Pentlands as well, isn't there?
I'll admit, I'm in love with the Pentlands. I think the Pentlands are just wonderful hills. They've got a bit of everything, but like you said, there's history, and if you really want to, there's a lot to find if you want to look for it. If you just stick on the ridges and don't really open your eyes or read about the Pentlands, it's easy to think they're just a bunch of low hills, but there's so much to discover about the Pentlands. And every time I go back to the Pentlands, I discover something new. I see them painted in a slightly different way. I love the Pentlands.
Yeah, I my first time in the Pentlands, I've done the classic Pentland skyline route, and then I went back again about a year later, I think it was. Can't quite remember the timing, but anyway, I ventured into the other side of the Pentlands, where it's a bit more boggy, and it was October, I believe, as well, and it'd been raining quite a lot. So that was an interesting experience. It wasn't so much hill running as it was probably more like hill wading a lot of the time. it's quite wild out in the other side of the Pentlands there, isn't it?
There's some rough stuff further south. I was in a place called Bawdy Moss this time last week, last Thursday, and it's part of the watershed of Scotland, and you've got this point where the land is quite flat, and it's full of tussocks, and the ground is just sopping wet underneath you. You know, the ground holds you, but you're in mush. And it's just this wonderful moment of just calmness, no one around at all. And you're on the watershed, and you almost feel under your feet, the water sort of deciding North Sea or Atlantic Ocean. You know, where shall I go? It was great to be on that point. And again, that's the Pentlands. You can just find, you know, these little places where no one goes, or very rarely trod.
Yeah, are you like trying to do all the different hills in the Pentlands or something? I'm sure I saw something on Strava or...
Yeah, there's this little guidebook written by Rab Anderson, who, and he lists the 152, the hills, the rises, and some of the definition he uses, and some of them have a prominence of just a few metres next, as opposed to, you know, compared to the next summit. But it's a really good way of seeing different hills. I've done about 93-94 out of 152, so I'll get there by the end of the summer, probably, maybe before. But yeah, that's a good way of seeing the hills. I think the list could probably be updated to some hills or some bumps I probably shouldn't be in there, and some bumps that perhaps could be in there. But yeah, it's just something different. You know what it's like. If you run in the same place lots of times, It's good to just find different ways of linking things together and different places to go. Mm-hmm. Just keeps it fresh.
Yeah. You mentioned as well earlier on that you you don't really do any walking in the hills anymore. It's always, you always go to run. And I resonate with that quite a lot, because I've done a lot of hill walking years ago as well. And I still do occasionally. But last weekend, I actually went out and done a loop up in Glen Clover, done some hill running. And the family were then coming out to walk the dog up Loch Brandy afterwards. So I'd done my loop and got back to the start point, met them, started walking, and it just felt, it was great. It was great to be with people after being running around on my own for so long, you know, and having a chat and everything. But it just felt so slow. I was like, I'm not getting anywhere, you know. It's a totally different experience, isn't it?
Yeah, I get, for me, it's driven out of necessity. It sounds like you've got family yourselves, and I've got three children now, age one and 1, 6, and 8. And I don't have time to just spend time just walking, because it just feels like, I don't want to say a waste of time, because that's sort of a very good use of time. But as a runner, I want to maximize the time I've got. And isn't it, running in the hills is fantastic, because even though sometimes, even if the ground's rough, you can't travel that far. You can't travel that quickly, can you? And sometimes 3 miles per hour might be a good pace, you know, for several hours, if it's up and down and if the terrain's really awkward. But still, running has that magical quality. You could just get so far in a relatively short space of time, and you can look to the distance and think, I can be on that hill. I can make that ground and be back. And it isn't that long. Whereas, you know, I did a long run last weekend. That was 36 miles. And you couldn't walk that in daylight hours. It would be a long, long walk. And you need lots more food and water and everything else, more breaks, because you're pretty tired, but you can run it in under 10 quite comfortably.
So that was a long day out. Was there any highlights from that? That would have been one of your first sort of, in Scotland, we've been allowed to travel further afield again, haven't we? So you've managed to get away from the Pentlands for a change of scenery. So how was that then?
Honestly, it's quite a dilemma. Like, it was Pentlands or anywhere in Scotland, and it was still, I was thinking, Pentlands? But so we drove up to Dromocta, and a lot of people know the little lay-by by Balsbarran cottages. So we just parked there and then just went straight up the bank to get to the two Munros on the east side of Dromocta. And then there's a Munro much further north, just above Dalwhinnie. So we went to get that one, and then we crossed the A9, went up the loch a bit, and then came up the ridge of Gilcharn, and then did those four Munros on the west side. As a sort of big 36-mile loop. It was just fantastic to be out, and it was brilliant to Gilcharn is the first Munro I climbed when I came to. Well, I've lived in Scotland twice. I lived in Inverness for a bit, and then I've lived in Edinburgh for 6 years now. But Gilcharn was the first Munro I climbed when I came to Scotland to live in Inverness. I climbed it on the way up north when I moved up here, and so it's resonated with that sort of the memories of what had been 12 years earlier of climbing that hill. And you just get the most fantastic view from those Dromocta West Hills over to Ben Alder, across Loch Eric. And as the friend I was running with, he just said, there's just so much fun to be had, because you could see the Cairngorms, you could see Sheehalion, you could see obviously Ben Alder, and all the peaks around that, which I haven't climbed, and it was sort of, you know, licking our lips, or, you know, what there was to come, and on these snow-covered mountains, and it just reminds you, you know, what's out there, and there's just so much to do, and in some ways it's quite daunting. Oh God, there's just too much to do. You know, what next is there to do? Hopefully the start of an exciting summer, or spring summer.
Yeah, hopefully. I'm actually away to Cyprus this year, so I'll be missing out on a lot of the hill running this year. But I'll try to get up to the Cyprus Hills. And there's Troodos Mountain Range there, so
is it quite mountainous, Cyprus, isn't it?
Yeah, there is a mountain range there, Trudos Mountains. Yeah, so there's Mount Olympus is the sort of main, the highest peak on the island. Yeah, so it'll be a bit different from the Scottish Hills, but it'll be good to explore a bit.
I think there'll be less bog.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah, we're renowned for a good bog.
Yeah, we're very dry and stony, I imagine.
Yeah, it's you've mentioned as well about how quickly you can cover ground, and that's definitely one of the things that appeals to me with hill running as well. It's just how fast you can, if you go for a walk in the hills, like you say, it can take a very long time to cover ground, and as you're moving, you could be moving slowly, but then as soon as you get a good downhill or something. One of the things I love about hill running is when you run down a hill and you get a good hill to run down, you can be at the top of a Munro. So you're talking like potentially 1,000 meters up and to the bottom of that hill in like minutes if you're going down pretty fast. And you look back up and you're like, what? I was just up there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And say if you're in on a ridge and you're on the top and then you come down to the col, then you look back and you think, oh, that was 8 minutes. Yeah. And then up again, that'd be 20 minutes, and then down again. It's incredible, isn't it? Time, you can just really make ground quickly. Yeah, magical, brilliant.
Yeah, it really is, yeah. It's really, a lot of people, going back to what we said earlier on about people thinking it's a bit mad, the amount of times you notice yourself and you're running up a hill and you get some funny looks, you get some funny comments, you get people that are, a lot of people I find are quite inspired by it, and they're like, "Oh, well done! Keep on," and they give you this encouragement and stuff, which I think is great. But there's a lot of people as well that I've spoken to that say like, "Oh, I'd love to be able to do that. I'd love to be able to run up in the hills, but I'm just, you know, I just don't have the fitness, or I don't think I could do it." Essentially, so kind of self doubt. Do you ever experience people saying that? And what would you say to them if they did say that?
It's a mentality though, isn't it?
So,
I'm a teacher, and to get to my classroom, I'm on the second floor, and I walk up those steps sometimes, and I think, oh, my legs are so tired. And I walked up about 40 steps, and I know that night I'll probably run the Pentland Sky Line or something, and I'll climb 6,000 feet in 3 hours. And it's that sense of mentality, isn't it? I think if you are a walker and you're walking up a hill in a pair of big boots and you're carrying like a day sack and your head is, I'm walking today, then, and you see a runner run past, then it does seem like chalk and cheese. But I think if people set off with the mentality of a runner, i.e. the right shoes on, lightweight, with a real goal of going to different places and realizing they can move, they can travel a bit further. I think that mentality will help them make that transition if they want to. And you know yourself that there's no shame in walking up a hill, you know, to march up the hill. And then once you get to the top, you know, the hill runner will move off. That they'll run the flats. They'll, you know, try to accelerate downhill. And that's the difference between the walker and the runner, that, you know, sometimes the runner will sort of march up the hill with hands on thighs but they'll move off at the top and they'll make progress. And that's when you become a dot on the horizon to the walker.
Yeah. That's quite often one of the things I say as well. You mentioned there about, they've got a big bag on with all their stuff and they've got their lunch and maybe their tent and whatever else they need in there because they're going to be out for so long. Quite often they'll be like, oh, wow, that's amazing. Look at how fast you're running up the hill. But then quite often I say to them, well, you've got all that, you know, you've got all that stuff on your back there. It's actually potentially harder for you, and you're out there for longer as well. So in a way, it can be harder to walk in the hills than it can to run sometimes. Do you agree with that, or do you think that's better?
Yeah, I do. And it's that sense that as a walker, you are probably more prepared than you perhaps need to be. Mm-hmm. Whereas with running in hills, it's quite a delicate line, isn't it? You've always got just enough kit, just enough food, just enough liquid to get by, haven't you? And you know that if the storm comes in, you know, you're going to get wet and miserable. And if you overestimate the distance and you run out of food, you're going to feel pretty hungry, but you just sort of get on with that, don't you? Whereas I think the walker would probably be a bit more prepared because they can carry more stuff, can't they? Or they choose to carry more stuff.
Yeah, definitely. And and sometimes, like you say, it goes back to that mentality thing that you just said there. You can get cold and wet and hungry. So you mentioned the Bob Graham round earlier on, and I think you mentioned the Rigby round as well. So there's also the Ramsey round. Do you want to explain to the listeners a little bit about the rounds and maybe some of your experiences, maybe some mental tough points that you've had to push through in the past?
Yeah, certainly. Just to reiterate on the point I just mentioned, I don't want to make hill runners sound like they're unprepared. The hill runners I know are really well prepared and like are prepared for any. Are prepared for adversity. Do you know what I mean? I think I made it sound like we're all a bit reckless there, but we're not. I think hill runners are very much prepared. And there's a difference between going for a 1 hour run in Independence on a lovely summer's afternoon to, you know, spending 8 hours in the Mamors. Sorry, anyway, on to the rounds, which is
you're spot on to mention that. And even to reiterate even further from my point of view as well, I find that as a hill runner and other hill runners that I know, and no offence to walkers out there as well, a lot of walkers will go out into the hills with maybe like a Google Maps printout or something, you know, and just head out. A lot of runners do a lot of preparation in the routes. They've got to think about their navigation. They've got to think about what if something goes wrong here and there. You know, it's like you're travelling light, but you still have the necessary safety stuff, waterproofs, etc., to keep yourself safe.
I found the same with climbers, because I didn't know many climbers, and I did interview a few climbers for the book, just sort of not deliberately but by accident, because a lot of people come into hill running different ways. Some people are runners and they come into hill running, and some people are more mountain folk, like mountaineers or climbers, and then they come into hill running in that way. And the climbers I spoke to, I was still climbing, oh, they're crazy, they're mad, like properly, you know, they are bonkers doing those things. And like, I thought, oh, they're so brave and everything else. They're the most rational people I've met. Like, they just match their skill set to what they think they can achieve. So they're not doing something reckless. They just think, well, my skill set is this. I can do that thing in front of me, because they don't want to kill themselves, do they? You know, there's a limit to their recklessness. Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Anyway, so the rounds. So I suppose round running is a very traditional form of ultra hill and fell running, which is a tradition that's shared across England, Wales, Scotland and Ireland as well, of course. And I suppose the entry level 24-hour round is the Bob Graham, which a lot of people know about and has been romanticized in literature and made famous by people like Kilian Jornet and so forth. And then there's a Welsh round, the Paddy Buckley round, and there's a Scottish round, 24 round, the Ramses round. But beyond that, beyond those three, there are numerous rounds that some are 24 hours, some might take longer, some are a lot shorter. But I guess I really love that principle of that A to B, doing a big loop. And I love the pointlessness of it all, that idea of you start there and you just spend 22 hours or 24 hours just running in a big circle to get back to exactly where you started, and you've gone everywhere and nowhere. You've just come back to the beginning. With all of these things, it's a progression, isn't it? So as I said, at the time I saw the Bob Graham as just the most credible thing in the world, like the very pinnacle of endurance that I could reach. And then when you do these things, you think, oh, actually, I did it and I was okay, and I more than survived, and I think I can do something harder. And so I did Ramsey's round, and I guess it's not just a question of doing something potential that seems more difficult And, you know, Ramstrand is more difficult. You only have to look at the average finishing time for the different rounds and the number of people who have done Ramstrand compared to the Paul Graham. But it's more of a challenge because of sort of what's underfoot, basically. You're not running on paths. You're running on ridges. You're running on bare rock. It's awkward. It's difficult. And it's more exposed and it's more lonely and it's more prone to the vagaries of the weather. But it's not just doing things that are more difficult. It's doing things in a different way. So when I did the Bob Graham, I had support and I had my dad helping me out on various roads and so forth. When I did the Ramses Round, I had less support on the road and on the hill. And then you become more confident at these things. And then I did something called the Ring of Fire, which is round in the Galloway Hills, which I did have the fastest time for that until about a week ago and someone took it, which is good. And I did that on my own.
Are you going to go back and try it again?
No, that was one of the hardest things I've ever done. So the Galloway Hills were the roughest hills I've ever run on. They were rough and awkward and, that was tough. You spend the entire time looking at your feet, looking for every hole and divot. That was really a difficult day.
Yeah.
If someone's run faster, well done to them. They deserve to be the quickest. But I did that on my own, sort of with no support. And then you just get more confident. And then I did the Rigby round, which is the round of the 18 Munros in the north of the Cairngorms. And that was 70, for me, it was 71 miles. And if people are familiar with the Cairngorms, I did it from a different way. I did it from Glenfeshy, which upset the traditionalists a little bit, which meant I had to cross the Lowry Grew twice. So I came into the Lowry Grew and climbed out of it. And then on the way back, after I had been up Cairngorm, back into the Lowry Grew and climbed back out of it again to get onto the Bray Rhiach plateau, and that was extremely hard. But for that, again, no support, on my own, on-site navigation. And yeah, these things are not glorious. I remember being in utter agony coming off the last hill. I remember my Bob Graham, I finished like I was finishing a 10K, or certainly not the very end, but the bit on the road before. This Rigby round, I thought my legs were just buckling underneath me. And I got to my car and there was no one there. I had no food. I had a Satsuma and a packet of prawn cocktail crisps left. That's all I had. And a bottle of water. And I ate those things. And then it was like, well, what do I do now? But I didn't have camping gear with me. It was about 10:30 at night when I finished. And it was like, well, you know, this is the gritty reality of it. This is like the ultimate in looking after yourself. So I just love the way you go from the Bob Graham, where it's, you get your mates supporting you and giving you a drink and passing you food, and then there's your dad with tomato soup, and then you get to the end and you go back to your caravan and have a sleep, and then a few years later you're running a Rigby round on your own. Doing your own navigation out there in the middle of the night, being scared senseless, hoping for the best, like praying you can just cling on and get to the end before the sun goes down and you're into a second night. And then you get to the end and there's no one there. No one there to say well done. No one there to help you take your shoes off. No one there to drive you to a hotel or a B&B. And I got in my car and slept for a bit. And then slowly drove back to Edinburgh. I got to Edinburgh about 4 in the morning. And it was just, it's become increasingly over the years a question of not what, but how, a question of style, not just what I'm doing, a question of how I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And do you get even though there's no big party at the finish line, you know, like we get a big marathon or something like that, did you feel, well, what were your feelings when you got back to the car? You're just like, just exhausted, I'd imagine.
But again, you know yourself, but as soon as you stop, you feel okay, don't you?
Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? It goes back to that mentality thing again. You can be at a point where you're like, you feel that you can't move, And then all of a sudden you're back at your car and you're like, oh, I'm actually fine.
Yeah. I think with the Rigby in particular, there was this sort of shuddering sense of relief. It was like, because it wasn't just having done it, it was I've done it and I've got round safely. And I'm okay. You know, I've managed to do it. Just that relief that is quite overwhelming. But you know, real life spills back in quickly, doesn't it?
So how long was that on the rugby round? Just to give a bit of context to anyone listening who's not.
That was 21 hours 32, which, you know, is a long time, but it's nowhere near 24. You know, and another 2.5 hours is a hell of a lot longer to keep going for. So, it could have been worse, but I think it's that sense of being on your own, and there's no one to sort of look after you. Because I remember getting to the furthest, easternmost point on Ben Arne, 12 hours in, and I was absolutely exhausted. I don't think I've ever, I just wanted to lie down and sleep. And I've never felt like that. I've never felt that bad before. Mm. And there's just no one there to help. I do love those conversations though, that you have. And I remember I saw a woman on Ben Vane or one of the hills, maybe sort of 8 or 9 hills in. And that conversation, then they say, where have you come from? Are you going far today? And it's like, come from Ben Veshey and I'm trying to do 18 Munros. I love those conversations. We had a few of those even on Saturday doing the Dromokta Hills. And oh, you're just doing these two? No, I'm actually doing 7 and we've just been all the way over there. And yeah, I love those things.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been having a few of them recently because I've been doing some Everesting training, going up and down.
Yes.
Like East Lowen's my probably the biggest local hill I've got nearby. It's not that big, it's quite small, but it's a fair bit of elevation if you go up and down a few times. There's a lot of walkers out there, so you pass them quite a few times. What are you doing? What are you running up and down? How many times are you going to do it? And they're just mesmerized, you know? And it's like,
you again.
That's it, yeah. It's interesting to open people's eyes, I think, to a kind of different side of the hills, you know, as opposed to just going out for a walk and enjoying the view, which is great. There's nothing wrong with that. But you can have so much fun out there as well, you know, running about like a madman.
just trying to find your own limits. That there's a lot to experience if people want to experience it.
Yeah. So, what have you got planned upcoming in our anything now that things are starting to open back up? Are you thinking of doing another round or anything, or what's your?
I don't know. I'm not sure. It's hard, isn't it? Because I'm well aware that these things can be quite demanding, and so I'm well aware that you could do something like this and then it can write off the next 2 or 3 months of your running or your summer. So you want to choose the right thing. And as I've always been absolutely transfixed by things I've done, so the bog ground transfixed me, the Ramses round obsessed me, even the rugby was something that only occurred to me. I'd known about it for years, but it only really fixated in my mind to do it maybe a month before. But my goodness, that month was like obsession, right? I'm going to do this. I'm going to read every single word on it. You know, think about it. Obviously, you can't do much wrecking on it. You're not allowed to. But for me, something needs to like crawl under my skin and like take over me and make me, you know, wake up in the night and think about that thing. And at the moment, nothing's doing that to me. I have got the one thing that's ticking in my head is to do maybe the Scottish 4000s, which is the 9 hills over 4,000 feet. Mm-hmm. So 5 in the Cairngorms, 4 in Loch Arbour, and then link the two. So you can start at Glenmore or start at Glen Nevis and then cross Scotland, basically. Munros, long run in the middle, Munros. That's about 80 miles. Mm-hmm. So I think that's quite doable. Again, it's a 24-hour thing. Again, I'm in that sort of confusion about style. Do I do it solo? Well, it would be solo, but do I do it with support or not with support? Because ultimately, if you do it with support, you can try and have a crack at a decent time. If you don't do it with support, you accept that you're not going to be flying along, because there are going to be like lows where, you know, there's not much that will get you out of those, just time and plodding on. Yeah. So yeah, maybe that. And there's a few Ramses round attempts. Well, I think there'll be a lot of Ramses round attempts this year. But there's a couple that I may well be helping out with. Yeah. And who knows, something may grab me. And I'll do more long stuff in the Pentlands as well.
Yeah, good stuff. Obviously. Yeah. A lot to look forward to, fingers crossed.
Yeah, it's always hard to balance, again, your own desires with family as well. There's always that sort of delicate balance, isn't it, of trying to keep yourself happy, but keeping everyone else happy as well. I find that quite tricky. Yeah. Finding that sweet spot where you're being a husband and you're being a father, and you're also doing the things that make you feel human as well, make you feel alive.
Yeah. Well, these kind of challenges, I mean, they're so big that they take a lot of training. You know, there's not really any way around it. You have to get out in the hills, don't you, and train. So it's like, it's a delicate balance between, especially if you're working as well. It's different if you're like a paid athlete and you can just, you know, yeah, chill out and run several times a day, whatever, you know, and then have all the perfect sort of, yeah, scenario. But if you're living a so-called normal life, it can be very tricky to find that balance. Well, is there any kind of, any things you use, techniques, any kind of tips you would have to anybody who is struggling to find that balance in their training,
ooh,
life? Or is,
I think you have to be honest with whoever you live with. And if this is something you want to do or need to do, you need to be honest about that. And you need to work out how you can find time. So in the working week, I find time quite tricky to find. So tomorrow morning, I'll meet a group of people and run up in the Pentlands at 6 a.m. I'll do an hour and a half or so, and I'll be back in time to go to school, go to work. So it's just finding time that doesn't interfere with other people's time. So it's your time. So when I do that, I don't feel any guilt at all, because it's my time, because everyone else is asleep in bed. So it just comes down to that thing of if you want to do it, you'll find a way. Yeah, we're all busy, aren't we? But we all fritter away a lot of time doing things that watching TV or on social media or just stuff that...
Binge watching Netflix.
Yeah, I do, you know, I am efficient with my working life. But again, I think that has partly come from having three children. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't got all day to, you know, I don't stop and have a half an hour chat with my work colleagues, because I just know that if I don't do this marking at school now, I just won't do it. So I am quite efficient, and that efficiency runs across my entire life. I think my efficiency irritates my wife as well, because say at night I'll have the porridge will be soaked, the tea's ready to go in the morning, everything's ready to go, and my clothes are laid out. I'm not OCD about it. I want to be prepared and ready, so I'm not wasting time on finding a pair of socks, or, you know, if I have to hold a baby because he's crying for 10 minutes or half an hour, at least I've got my breakfast. I can just throw straight in the microwave and eat it. It's just finding time, making time as well. And if you really want it, you'll make time.
Yeah.
There's a guy I know, and he's got a Ramsey attempt at the end of May. I look at him on Strava. His runs start at 5:20, 5:10. He just gets out of bed really early. He gets going.
Mm-hmm. I think that's great advice. I think that preparation is for a lot of people in their lifestyles is key, because like you say, if you're getting up in the morning and you're kind of half asleep and you're trying to dig out all your stuff, it's just you take a lot of time up, you know. Whereas if you prepare it the night before, then you're good to go in the morning, aren't you? So that's great. Speaking of being efficient with time. Speaking of being efficient with time, I don't want to keep you too long, because I know it's getting quite late. Anybody watching on YouTube can see that my room is starting
to
get dark. Yeah, you need to get your porridge set up and your shorts out. It's quickly before we shoot off. Do you want to quickly talk about what you think for the future races? Because we haven't really touched upon races. Scottish Hill Racing's something that I've been kind of getting immersed in lately, and well, before pre-COVID, and obviously you're big into the Scottish Hill running scene for a long time. So where do you see the future of it going then?
It's interesting, isn't it? There are big races going on, aren't there? There's the Glencoe Skyline Series, as far as I know, is happening. That's September. So I still think those companies will organise those big sort of high-ticket events, the series that was on Arran last year, for example. Mm-hmm. But I think some of the smaller races will, who knows what happens to those. But Scottish Hill Running is not some great big commercial enterprise. It's pretty low key. It relies on the volunteering efforts of quite a small number of people across clubs that are fairly small as well. And it requires a lot of goodwill. It requires, for example, something like the Penton Skyline or the Kyne 85 requires an incredible amount of goodwill from landowners that a lot of competitors have no idea is the case. And so when certain routes are marked out on the Kyne 85 and also the Penton Skyline, and people have a little moan about it, it's like, well, we're just trying to keep the landowner happy. And if you don't keep the landowner happy, the race won't be run. And I guess the things we've chatted about is maybe after a couple of years of no races, these landowners will be like, well, I'm quite happy with a race not coming across my land and disturbing my sheep when they're in lambing season. So who knows? My hope is that all the races come back and things go on as normal. I'm sure some will go and maybe new ones will begin. It's also a shame for some runners as well. There are some runners who, I don't know, they may have been at the end of their 40s or at the end of their 50s. And for some runners, they may not run or race in the way they did ever again, because they've missed 2 years of racing, and suddenly they've gone from being 54 to 56, or they've gone from 40 to 42, and they've just maybe missed an opportunity to race. And same with a lot of younger runners, because there's been no races, there's been no younger people racing in the hills, and where have those young people gone? What are they going to do instead? Because there is a natural transition at an age that's more impressionable, where you get younger runners coming through. And that's what the sport obviously needs, because there's plenty of old codgers doing hill running, but it needs sort of younger blood.
Yeah, definitely. Well, fingers crossed for the future. And that gap there, a couple of years of people not having the motivation to train for racing as well, it's like stuff can just kind of fall to the wayside. So
it depends on your outlook as well, because for me, Scottish hill running is not about racing. Mm-hmm. If you told me there's never going to be a race ever again, I'd be like, okay, that's fine, I don't mind that. But for some people, Scottish hill running is racing, and I'm well aware of that. And people, live by that social interaction and running those familiar routes and so forth, and mm-hmm. just having the chat at the end and everything else. For me, that cliche, there's always the hills, and if there's a race in them, great. If there's not, then we'll still be there.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you on that one, Johnny. Definitely.
Well, a lot of people are on that, but some people do live by racing and have lost their motivation because of a lack of a tangible aim. Mm-hmm. Whereas I don't measure my hill running by the outcome of a race. In fact, I find it counterproductive. Sometimes I race and I'm really disappointed, because in our heads we're better than we think we are, aren't we? And so I'll do a race and thinking, oh, I was like 24th and I was a minute slower than last year and that's rubbish. And you get home and feel really rotten about yourself. Whereas I haven't felt like that for a year and a half because it's like I haven't raced. So I think I'm brilliant.
Yeah. Do you feel like you've managed to be more consistent without having to do races as well?
Definitely. And there's not that pressure of, oh, I've got to train tonight because I've got stuck a groin or I'm going to Jura and have to do a certain type of training. And you can just back off if you feel a little tweak in your calf. There's no pressure of racing, so therefore training to race. And also there's no pressure to have those eyeballs out effort. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you'll hammer down the hill at the end of a race and you're well aware that something is just, you know, you rolled your ankle or you've hurt your Achilles or, you know, your groin hurts or you something in your thigh. So those sort of things haven't happened because you don't need to make those big eyeballs out effort.
Yeah. Great fun at the time, but sometimes it's a big risk to take a lot of the time, isn't it? Yeah,
exactly. And the adrenaline takes over, but you know, that's 2 weeks or 4 weeks gone.
Yeah. Well, good stuff. Yeah, I'll let you go and get your porridge soaked, Johnny. And thanks again for coming onto the podcast. It's been great finally to meet you and have a chat. And for the listeners, where can they find you? You're on Instagram as Johnny Muir Mountains.
Yes, yeah, and Twitter is Muir_Johnny. Yeah.
And you've got your blog as well, which is it Heights of Madness?
Yeah, so it's named after the book I wrote on I went around and climbed the highest point in every county in 2006, and I made the blog then. So it's named after that book, and I just kept the name Heights of Madness, which I appreciate absolutely flies in the face of everything I was saying at the start of our chat about madness and people being mad for doing these things. But that was 15 years ago, so I can be forgiven.
No,
and good luck with your own efforts with your Everesting and everything else, and I'll follow with interest.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes. The training's going well so far, so we'll hope it keeps going that way, and hopefully I'll catch up with you sometime in the hills. That'd be
amazing. Yeah,
yeah, never know, might bump into each other one day out there.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks again, Johnny, and great chatting to you tonight.
Yeah, same. All the best. Thank you.
Yeah, all the best. Cheers. Thank you for listening. I really hope you enjoyed the episode. I hope this conversation has brought you something. And if it has, please could you leave a review on your favourite podcast platform. Also, if there's anyone you know who would benefit from the information that you listened to today, please could you share this with them as well. It's great to spread the love. And if you could head over onto YouTube as well, you'll see that all these conversations are recorded and that's another great way to get this content. So please subscribe on YouTube. Please subscribe on your favourite podcast outlets. It's on Apple, Spotify, the usual kind of places. And I would love if you could get involved in the comments sections. Leave any feedback in there, positive, negative thoughts, feelings. I would love to hear what's going on. And also any suggestions for any future episodes, any topics you'd like to hear discussed, any people that you'd like me to try and get onto the podcast. I just want to make sure that this podcast is bringing you as much benefit as the listener that I possibly can. Thanks again for listening. Take care, stay healthy, stay happy. Catch you all in the next episode.